After an assassin killed Charlie Kirk for his ostensibly hateful views, millions began grieving, but a bunch of others took the opportunity to vent their spleen against Charlie Kirk's conservative ideas and even mocked the grievers. And then some of these, notably Jimmy Kimmel, lost their jobs. Is this a kind of right-wing cancel culture, and is it at odds with the American principle of free speech? Hello, everybody. I'm Graham Walker, coming to you from Independent Institute in Oakland, California. And we are going to explore this question and related ones on today's episode of Independent Conversations. I'm joined today by my colleagues, Philip Magnus and Williamson Evers. Phil holds our David J. Thoreau Chair in Political Economy, and Bill is our education expert and all-around polymath. Welcome to you, Phil and Bill.
Happy to be here.
Glad to be here.
But most importantly, today, we also welcome someone who has thought long and deeply about free speech issues, Nadine Strossen, formerly longtime president of the American Civil Liberties Union. Welcome, Professor Strossen. So glad to have you.
I'm delighted to be here, Graham, and I hope we can be on a first-name basis.
Okay, if you want to be Nadine, you shall be.
Thank you.
That's great. Okay, so also, before we start talking about the subject, let me congratulate you on your highly relevant new book just out titled The War on Words, which is 10 arguments against free speech and why they fail. And let me just show our friends what the cover of this book looks like so they can take a look at it when they go to Amazon.com or their local bookstore. There it is, co-authored with Greg Lukianoff, The War on Words, highly relevant for our discussion today.
Thank you so much for promoting it.
Well, we hope our friends go and take a look and buy several copies. So, Nadine, you have more than 40 years of experience in First Amendment law. Were Jimmy Kimmel's First Amendment rights, free speech rights, violated when ABC canceled his show?
It all depends on what the motive behind the cancellation was, Graham. ABC, as a private sector actor, many people are surprised to learn, is not bound by the First Amendment. The First Amendment says, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. Now, the Supreme Court has long and unanimously interpreted that word Congress to mean not just the legislative branch of the federal government, but all government officials and agencies at every level, national, state, and local.
Due to the 14th Amendment, right?
Yes, thank you. And its interpretation in terms of state officials. But at the national level of government, even before the 14th Amendment, the word Congress was understood to refer also to the national executive and, for that matter, judicial branch. Thank you for that nice point of clarification. So private sector entities, with one exception that I will soon get to, not only have no First Amendment obligation to platform anybody, they, to the contrary, have their own First Amendment free speech rights to pick and choose what speakers they will air and won't, what messages they will air and won't. So if ABC truly made an independent, I'm stressing that word in light of the name of my host platform here, if it were truly an independent decision to suspend Kimmel based, for example, on bad ratings or business considerations or even the political preferences of those who make the editorial decisions at ABC, that would be an exercise of First Amendment rights, far from a violation of them. But, and here is where the facts are really important, if it was not really an independent decision, but was in fact motivated by the pressure that came from FCC Chair Brendan Carr, as well as other government officials, threatening actually quite explicitly, but even an implicit threat, that there would be adverse government sanctions if ABC did not suspend Kimmel, the Supreme Court wisely has recognized that that should in effect be treated as government action, that the government is not permitted to do indirectly what it clearly could not do directly. So, you know, Brendan Carr could not just reach out and say, Jimmy Kimmel, you're off the air. But nor should he be able to indirectly accomplish the same result by putting such pressure on the company or such encouragement, let's use a more positive framework, that it really was, in effect, a governmental decision. And I think, you know, one thing one can say about the Trump administration, including Carr, is that they are quite explicit about the pressure. I want to stress the Biden administration also did a lot of what is called jawboning, particularly with respect to social media platforms and speakers when the comments were contrary to Biden administration policy, particularly regarding COVID and the elections. And a number of companies, including Google most recently, have come forth and said, you know, we really were subject to so much pressure to take down materials that didn't violate our own content moderation policies. This was not really an independent editorial decision. It was due to government pressure. Well, you know, for better or worse, the Trump administration is so transparent that I think this could fairly be seen as a result of governmental coercion rather than a truly independent ABC decision, and therefore raises serious First Amendment problems.
I would say it was reinforced. Your point is reinforced by the fact that it wasn't more than, what, 5 days later or so that ABC changed its mind. It's not because they had finally listened to the tape of what Kimmel said. I'm sure they had listened to it from the first moment, but rather because I think they didn't really want to do it in the first place. That's how I interpret it as a layman. What do you think, Phil Magnus?
Well, I think jawboning is the exact issue here that we need to dig into. And, you know, we all remember this happening during COVID, during the Biden administration, although the evidence for it, again, came out often well after the fact. It was Mark Zuckerberg going to Congress and saying, yes, we actually did get contacted by government officials, and they told us these types of posts should be taken down. And the pressure was absolutely intense, but we're seeing the same tactics play out in the Trump administration. I was actually just reading a few minutes ago that one of the latest examples of controversy in this is they've pressured Apple into start taking down apps off of its website store, its cell phone app store, that have information on them, like reporting where ICE raids are occurring, example. And, you know, you look at this, a lot of us have apps on our own phones that also report where, like, the speed traps are on the road. And that's always conventionally been held as, like, a free speech thing. But here you have the government leaning on a private company saying, well, you know, you're impeding law enforcement if you allow this freely created sharing of information through an app to occur. And so far, Apple seems to be bending. So we see, again, you know, it's the Trump administration has been very overt that this is their intention. They're using a lot of the same tactics that we saw during the Biden administration, but it's worrying to me for that reason.
And, you know, one of my biggest challenges throughout my long career as a civil libertarian is trying to convince people, members of the public in general, but also politicians and government officials and even journalists, that they have to look beyond the particular facts and the particular message and the particular speaker to the underlying principle, because the politics can change in a heartbeat. So let me illustrate it through this jawboning situation. A major precedent that has been relied on by entities that are resisting that kind of pressure from the government, including Harvard University and its lawsuit against the administration, various law firms, because they also have been subject to overt pressure to suppress free speech. And the major precedent that is being relied on came from the Supreme Court, a unanimous decision just last year, in which the ACLU, very controversially among our membership, defended the free speech rights of the NRA. We were talking before the show started about the ACLU has never, you know, focused on defending Second Amendment rights, but we certainly defend free speech rights for those who do full-time advocate for Second Amendment rights. And we got so much pushback from members and even some of our state-based so-called affiliates to the ACLU because they so detested the message of the NRA. And let me just spell out the politics, because this was at a state level. People may not be familiar with it. The case came from the Cuomo Democratic gubernatorial administration in New York State, which was very anti-NRA and, you know, anti-gun owners' rights. And a top official in that administration who had a great deal of regulatory power over the financial sector, banking and insurance companies and so forth, put pressure on them that they would, you know, hinted that they quite strongly that they would be subject to adverse regulatory actions if they did not cease doing business or strike the double negatives, unless they stopped doing business with the NRA. And, you know, I had to explain to so many of my liberal friends, how can the ACLU defend the NRA? And I said, look, if the Cuomo administration can do that to the NRA, the DeSantis administration can do it to the ACLU itself. And now we have the Trump administration doing it to its critics.
Bill Evers, I think you have a question.
Oh, I always have questions. So in your book, you say that full and equal access to the means for effective communication is something that people are really entitled to. And your conservative readers are going to see this as not really standing by property rights. If you say that people should have full and equal access to the means for effective communication, you're actually going against what you just said earlier when you said that private sector entities have no First Amendment obligation to platform anybody. I took notes on what you were saying. And obviously the court in the Miami Herald case, 1974, said there the state law that had a mandatory right of reply, that was infringing on really the property rights of the Miami Herald's owners. And Justice Hugo Black was often very explicit about this. He was unhappy. There was a case of sort of a public forum in a shopping mall idea. It was called Logan Valley Plaza. And he said, no, this court is wrong on this. The people that own this shopping mall have a right to control their own area and not have encampments of speakers or petitioners or whatever. And he famously also argued that the heckler's veto thing that's a major part of your book, and in a sense, one of the most timely aspects of your book is you treat assassination as an extreme form of heckler's veto. Anyway, I just think that your conservative readers are going to be dismayed at the absence of private property analysis in there, often extremely appropriate, and people like Hugo Black have used it explicitly.
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much. That is an ambiguity that never even occurred to me. I would never advocate requiring private platforms of any sort to be open to the public for speech. What I was urging, and this is a big part of FIRE's work as well as my own advocacy, is that we have to search for civil society measures, cultural measures, educational measures, private sector actions that will promote free speech. It's not only a matter of government law and government coercion. And I'm sorry that created the wrong implication that I was seeking government-mandated access. Not at all, just encouraging.
Well, the phrasing is, you know, people are entitled to full and equal access to the means of effective communication.
Not as a legal right. I see that.
I understand. You're hoping that we have a culture that encourages
exactly,
that.
Exactly. Okay. And just so, as I would oppose, you know, government measures to stifle cancel culture, I hope that civil society will itself reject cancel culture and adopt a free speech culture. Let me give you one even more current example, Bill. Maybe we're going to get to it. And that is the recent decision by the Supreme Court in the NetChoice case, where the ACLU joined, to the best of our knowledge, with a whole free speech community, rejecting efforts by government. In this case, it was one law from Texas and one from Florida that were seeking to constrain content moderation decisions by platforms, or put affirmatively requiring them to host certain expression that they had chosen not to. Absolutely contrary to First Amendment. And the Supreme Court agreed with that, with quite an ideological spectrum of justices agreeing, fortunately. You know, in the end, I oppose the so-called fairness doctrine that used to exist on broadcast media. And I have to tell you, very, very often when I'm speaking in college audiences, they'll say, oh, shouldn't we have a fairness doctrine for the internet? I mean, it sounds so
good, you get this from liberal and conservative
exactly.
students. It's not just one side or the other that think this.
Yes.
So this is related to this right of reply. It's a version of that statute that Florida
and it's had. Coerced speech, which the Supreme Court has rightly said, going back to a very old ACLU case in 1943, before the court started to strongly protect free speech rights. In a very famous case, the ACLU defended the right of Jehovah's Witness school children not to be coerced to salute the American flag. And
the
they
Barnett
could have raised
cases.
The religious freedom right, but the Supreme Court issued a very broadly worded, eloquent decision about freedom of conscience, freedom of thought, and it made
the second time.
Yes, it made a point. You're right. They changed their minds, which is kind of interesting and doesn't happen, and perhaps as often, even among ordinary human beings, not on the Supreme Court. I use that as an object lesson. You know, admit that you were wrong and confess error, and don't be embarrassed about it. It's more embarrassing to persist in the error. But the Supreme Court said, and I agree with this, Bill, and it does apply to these private platforms, that even more of an intrusion on individual autonomy and freedom of thought and stopping somebody from saying something they do want to say, it's even more of an intrusion to force them to say something or to, you know, enable somebody
compelled
else
speech.
To say something
exactly.
that they reject. Yeah.
So, you know, you have the crying, shouting fire in a crowded theater and falsely shouting fire and so forth. Analyze.
Thank you. I thank you.
I know it's important to say falsely, yes. But again, you know, going back to what Hugo Black was saying about going into a theater and making a speech, and you didn't buy a ticket that entitled you to make a speech. You bought a ticket that entitled you to hear the play or hear the movie or something like that. If you're shouting down the speaker at an event, you're violating the property rights of the owner who's putting on the event. The same is true for shouting fire. If you're shouting fire, if you're the owner, you're defrauding the person that's attending, because instead of seeing the movie or the play, they're seeing everybody run around.
Except,
if you're
a patron.
If you're a patron, you're violating the rights of the theater owner to put on his event.
And I know
none of this is in the book. That's what troubles me.
Oh, well, you know, take it up with our editor. We would have loved to have written a much longer.
No, it's
much
one
more
of the best parts of it is how short it is.
But, you know, brevity means that you always have to leave out certain nuances. And I understand that you are understandably reading the word entitled as referring to a legal right. And if I ever have a chance to do a new edition, I will try to rephrase it to make it clear that that was not the intent. I should have had you as an editor, Bill, except you probably would have made it too long.
No, I think brevity is a very, very good aspect of this book.
Yeah.
I mean, we were showing the cover, but this is, look, it's like 100 pages long.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
about another one of the arguments, because it's so relevant to the tragic assassination of Charlie Kirk, which Graham referred to in his introductory remarks. And that is that... So let me just give you a little bit of background. Greg Lukianoff, who's the CEO of FIRE, and I'm a senior fellow with FIRE, both of us are constantly traveling the country and even beyond the U.S. speaking about free speech. And we keep encountering the same questions, the same arguments over and over and over again. And we never get tired of responding to them in person. But we also thought it would be efficient to collect the most important arguments and counterarguments in written form. And we independently came up with our list of what we each thought were the 10 most important, most common arguments. And then the editor also independently did that. And every single one of us, all three of us, concluded that the most ubiquitous, most dangerous, most pervasive, wrong-headed and dangerous argument is what we included as point number one. Words are violence. Sadly, surveys show this is not just a figure of speech. Students really believe that words are violence, and therefore it is sadly not shocking that many students believe that actual violence is justified in order to silence words that they perceive as violence, so-called hate speech or extremist speech. In fact, FIRE's most recent of about 6 years now of annual surveys of college students, the largest ever done, just came out it came out the day before Kirk was assassinated on September 9th. 70,000 students were surveyed on 257 campuses. And it was shocking that a full 34% said that violence is at least sometimes justified to silence a speaker whose ideas you disagree with. And FIRE noted in its press release that this is among conservative students as well as liberal students. In the past, it had been more toward the left end. And in the press release that went out on September 9th, the chief data scientist behind this report, Sean Stevens, said, "This is not a Democratic problem. It's not a Republican problem. It's an American problem." And then the next day, Kirk is assassinated. So we have to really be, that's an argument that is not only wrong, it's an argument that is truly dangerous. Not that I would censor it, of course, but I want us to explain to people why it's dangerous.
It's interesting that, right, I mean, obviously this, we all know, and before this, in advance preparation, we looked at a ton of articles that discuss this words of violence, words are violence thing. But it's interesting, right after Kirk was assassinated, there's a philosopher who's a classical liberal named Jason Brennan, and he put on Facebook, one of the central tenets of classical liberalism is that words aren't violence. So both progressive liberals or left liberals or classical liberals or right liberals concur that words are not violence. Violence is violence. Physical violence and the threat of it is violence.
Words are the antithesis of violence, right? I mean, they're the alternative way to resolve disputes. And now it is true, and I do have to, and this segues into the pressure that is coming from individual citizens, but also from government officials, including J.D. Vance, of castigating and seeking to punish in various ways people that they see as celebrating Kirk's murder and somehow treating that as if it were an actual contributory factor. And so I think it's really important to stress the very but appropriately limited extent to which speech that has some connection to violence can be punished. It has to be a very tight and direct connection. The most important precedent here is another ACLU case, I'm proud to say, Brandenburg versus Ohio from 1969, decided unanimously. Every single justice since then has reaffirmed it. I mean, the general public might not support it, but the court is unanimous. And in that case, the Supreme Court said even advocacy of violence or lawlessness is constitutionally protected. For it to cross the line, there are a whole host of standards that have to be satisfied, which is that the speaker has to intentionally incite, and the word incite is used as distinguished from advocate, imminent violence or lawlessness that is likely to actually happen imminently. It's a tough standard, but an appropriately tough standard. Before that, we had a standard that was in allowed punishment of speech when there was a much looser, more nebulous, speculative connection between the words and the violence. And it's still used in many, many other countries, with leading to enormous censorship. It's usually called the bad tendency test. You know, even if words don't directly, imminently incite violence, if the words have a tendency to perhaps at some point in the future lead to potential violence, then they can be censored. As Oliver Wendell Holmes famously said in what was a dissenting opinion, every idea is an incitement. And by that, he didn't mean, therefore, let's censor every idea, but exactly the opposite. Unfortunately, in many other countries, ideas that are endorsing violence or are misperceived as doing so are, in fact, subject to censorship. And that's a very dangerous road for us to...
I wonder if we could flip Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr.'s views there and say, yes, every idea is incitement, and therefore incite, now wait a minute, because I'm going to take the Alexander Michael John position that actually Brandenburg was not good enough. Because, okay, all your criticism about the bad tendency test are correct, but incitement is still a rather vague thing, to some extent, in the discretion of the government deciding, this is what Michael John feared, that the line between advocacy and incitement is blurred, and I say, go do something. Go, you know, tear down the bakers because their prices are too high or whatever. You, the listener, have free will. You don't have to do that. You can stand where you are and let other people go over and attack the baker. They're the guilty people, not the speaker. And so unless you're part of a criminal organization and the Mafia Don is saying, go kill Guido, okay, that's not advocacy, that's not incitement, that's part of a structured hierarchical situation. So despite the ACLU and your books basically being satisfied with the Brandenburg test, it actually allows for a fair amount of government leeway. And, you know, remember what the clear and present danger was, supposedly people handing out leaflets saying don't comply with the military draft. I mean, the whole Vietnam War period was people handing out, clear and present danger, emergency, and incitement are all actually too vague.
You know, it's true that any legal standard gives some discretion to the government. In practice, I am happy to say that the Brandenburg test has been extremely strictly enforced and almost never satisfied, which leads to a lot of people complaining about it for the opposite reason. But it's completely different, I agree, from the bad history that we have with the clear and present danger test, which was applied to non-clear, non-present, non-dangerous situations.
It was taken out of tort law. In other words, let's say you have a stick of dynamite and it's lit. Okay, that's a clear and present danger. And then they're taking that over into the speech field. Anyway.
Well, you know, you will all be a recent development that I don't think has gotten as much attention as it should have. Donald Trump issued it was not an executive order. It was called a national security type of order, in which I don't have the exact language in front of me, but it's very, very vague language is the problem, in which he is advocating mandating full force government anti-terrorism forces and the joint terrorism task forces between the federal government, the state and local governments, and the FBI to investigate and punish so-called domestic terrorism, which is defined very broadly as extending to advocacy and discussion and what will clearly be protected speech.
It's almost as bad as the FBI treating parents and Catholics as terrorists.
Exactly. And in the columns I read about that, I quite frankly, that was alluded to, and I had not been aware of that. So I think both of these, on both sides of the aisle, the public is not as informed as it should be.
Well,
and I do think the public would be alarmed.
I would like to elicit Phil Magnus's input, because I can tell he has a couple of pretty pointed questions in his mind. But first, I'm going to toss one other thought in, which is that clearly the standard to justify government censorship of speech is and should be extraordinarily high and very difficult to justify. But I'm not the government. I'm a private person. When I hear people say inflammatory things, I can say, that's wrong. Don't do that. I'm ashamed of you. And I'm not violating the First Amendment when I say that.
You're exercising your rights.
Yeah,
exactly. I wrote a whole book whose title is Hate, Why We Should Resist It with Free Speech, Not Censorship. So it's exactly advocating counter speech. And in fact, in my book quotes human rights activists from all over the world opposing hate speech laws, not because they violate the free speech rights in their countries. They don't have protection against hate speech laws, but purely from the perspective of what is actually effective, right? Censorship, unfortunately, I mean, it's unfortunate for many reasons, but it doesn't accomplish the goal of seeking to suppress the message. Rather, it amplifies the message and creates more attention and usually more sympathy, rather than the opposite. So counter speech is both more principled and more effective.
Yeah, that's exactly. I guess first off, just an observation. I read that same order or directive that Trump gave to law enforcement, and it had all these vague, basically political stances that were described as supposedly terroristic. And one of them was anti-capitalism.
Right.
And I was sitting there reading that and thinking, wait a minute, I'm not sure J.D. Vance would pass this test. some of these advocates of, taking public ownership of corporations, is that capitalistic or anti-capitalist?
Oh, right. Well, it was, now you're refreshing my recollection, Phil, was anti-American, anti-Christian, and anti-capitalism.
Exactly.
And these people who say that Trump is destroying democracy, but he thinks he's saving democracy, right there. You know, who's
anti-American? Is that anti-American?
And pro-American.
Yeah, exactly. And then I guess the other factor that I see playing out here, I want to talk about this concept of cancel culture. The notion not only the government is leaning on private entities to jawbone or restrict free speech, but also like this mob mentality. And I think it gets more to the ethos of a society that respects free speech. And of course, we heard all about it during kind of the Biden years and some of the peak of wokeness, of cancel culture being directed at someone who said something crass or inappropriate on the right, but not illegal. And let's go after their jobs. Let's try to get them fired. And I'm seeing some of the same tendencies emerged in the wake of Charlie Kirk's assassination, where, one of the most absurd ones, there was a social media campaign I saw to get the manager of like a fast food chain in Florida fired because his wife posted something negative about Charlie Kirk on Facebook. And then you're also seeing that certainly it's spilled over into universities and public school teachers who may have said something extremely crass and condemnation worthy on their social media feeds, but not illegal. And yet the mob is coming for them, including some people of the same exact mob that complained 3 or 4 years ago when similar cancellation was directed at them. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on that. And where do the legal lines fall? What's the philosophical dimension of it? And, you know, how do we revive this culture of free speech in addition to the legal norm?
Yeah, it's a lot to unpack there. And it is a complicated issue because most folks who are engaging in so-called cancel culture are simply exercising their own First Amendment free speech rights. They have the right to criticize what somebody says, even to unfairly criticize it. They have the right to advocate that the person be punished, including disproportionately and too harshly punished. That is their free speech right. If, however, they are being egged on by government officials, it becomes a little bit similar to the jawboning situation that we talked about earlier. And what we have seen is I've been most closely following the university situation where even tenured professors have been suspended or fired. And I think the most notorious case was from a university in Texas where initially the president said, and this was not about Charlie Kirk, it preceded. So these were tactics. I mean, they've been turbocharged by his assassination, but it was happening before then. This was on so-called gender ideology. And the student who was complaining and trying to get her professor fired, at first, the president of the university said, well, that's not going to happen. And then a call comes from a powerful state government official saying you better do it or, you know, there'll be adverse consequences for you and your university. And suddenly, not only is the faculty member fired, but so is her dean and the chair of her department. And I think, to my knowledge, the most senior government official at the national level who's been, let's say, jawboning on the Charlie Kirk issue is J.D. Vance, who has urged people to ferret out examples of a disrespectful or insufficiently respectful statement and to cause a campaign to, you know, call their employer and pressure them to be fired. This gets back to another issue. These are so interrelated. We talked about the heckler's veto. The Supreme Court has said that government may not use as a justification for censoring speech the fact that other people, the hecklers who dislike the message, are complaining about it, even threatening violence. The Supreme Court said government has to respond by preventing the violence and protecting the speaker and the willing audience members. Let's not forget, they have a free speech right, a First Amendment right to hear the speaker. Well, this is kind of leading to a heckler's veto situation that is worse yet, being fomented by government officials. So deeply distressing. But getting back to your excellent point earlier, Bill, I would never, sorry, both of you or may all three of you have made relevant points here. Bill, I would never advocate any kind of government punishment of private people who are engaging in cancel culture. I would simply urge all of us to exercise self-restraint. You know, when I wrote my book about hate speech and was advocating counter speech, it was really before this cancel culture had blossomed. And I remember seeing a headline of an op-ed written by one of my colleagues in the free speech movement, Suzanne Nossel, who was then head of PEN America. And the headline of her column was, "When does counter speech go too far?" And I kind of did a double take. And she was not advocating censorship, but just self-restraint. If what we are trying to do is encourage a free speech culture, of course we want people to vigorously disagree and vehemently express their viewpoint, but not so vehemently that it results in intimidation and silencing, which is exactly the opposite of what we want to occur. So all of this comes back to education, information, creating it, you know, and I've would think that conservatives in the classic traditional sense would welcome this civil society emphasis. We're not asking for government solutions. We are asking those of us in the private sector and civil society and education and parents and community organizations, religious organizations, all of the cultural civic institutions to inculcate values of vigorous speaking, but respectful listening and conversation.
So one of the innovative aspects of your book with Greg is a stated desire to lessen the focus on the marketplace of ideas metaphor, put it at a lower level of importance. And Greg is also introducing an idea of information gathering and dispersal as an alternative metaphor that he would like to elevate. So I wanted to push back a bit on this. You know, your book was written and your main audience is sort of the open-minded, progressive, and liberal who's thinking of joining cancel culture or thinking of shouting down the speaker or thinking of deplatforming the speaker. You really weren't thinking of, oh, the right wing, it's going to start adopting this when you wrote it. So, you know, but one thing is that the marketplace of ideas, which, as you correctly point out, in Holmes's metaphor, doesn't guarantee the truth will emerge. It's just saying it's a process and it's going to have a tendency along these lines. And the same is true with information gathering by people that are trying to discover what's going on. I think Greg is a bit of a philosophical skeptic. In other words, he's saying, we can never know the truth. It's sort of a pretty strong statement there. But anyway, that's his shtick, which I think is a bit pessimistic. But he's right about, he borrows ideas from Karl Popper, who had this idea that in science, we make progress by making testable, falsifiable hypotheses, and then we go after them, and we have a community of people that are all trying to see what's really going on. And anyway, so that's kind of what he's liking. Now, the thing that's kind of peculiar also to a conservative or a libertarian is that these ideas about information are famously part of a paper by F.A. Hayek, the Nobel laureate in economics. He wrote a paper in the 1940s called The Use of Knowledge in Society. When Jimmy Wales co-founded Wikipedia, he said, I read The Use of Knowledge in Society when I was an undergraduate about how knowledge is dispersed. This is just exactly what Greg is saying when he's saying, we shouldn't have top-down control of knowledge. It needs to bubble up through contesting and endeavoring and so forth. And he praises Meta, but not X, which actually instituted it first, for community notes as a better way of fact-checking. This, again, is an illustration of Hayek's idea about the dispersal of knowledge rather than central plan type. Anyway, so there's a richness and a depth that could be there, as well as an appeal to a conservative reader, if Hayek had been cited and used. In fact, I didn't see a single conservative cited in the book.
You know, it's so interesting, Bill, because I am not a philosopher. I have never even studied philosophy. And so I have read John Stuart Mill. Maybe I alluded to Mill, but to the best of
my
knowledge,
there. There's
basically
a very good, one of the best parts of this book. It has several extremely wonderful things in it, but there's like two pages summarizing John Stuart Mill's argument in his essay on liberty. They are extremely tightly, beautifully, and accurately stated. So
now, you know, you may say that from your perspective, this is naive, but I truly do not think of the arguments as liberal or conservative.
I know, but one of the chapters is free speech is right wing. And so the idea implicit in that is a right wing is a bad thing. I'm just saying your reader, if he's a conservative, is going to...
No. Let's be very clear to your readers. We are responding to the most arguments we get.
But now, post-Charlie Kirk, it's the right-wingers are saying, oh, free speech is left-wing. And you don't have that parallel in there.
Yeah, okay, so we have to write another book.
Need more space again.
And I think the reason we address that marketplace metaphor is so many people say, well, free speech presumes that freedom of speech is going to lead to truth. And look at all the disinformation and misinformation. Doesn't that show that free speech is failing and therefore it shouldn't be protected? And that's
obviously intellectual.
That overstates what Holmes was saying, and there are many other independently sufficient rationales for free speech. But I think
including another one, which is kind of put down by Greg, and that is the Darwinian metaphor. He says that he kind of tags the marketplace of ideas metaphor as Darwinian, as if that's bad, which is kind of weird coming from what I think he probably believes in Darwinian natural selection. And famously, Richard Dawkins back in 1976 argued that we can think of cultural artifacts, which he calls memes, which is where we get the word for meme that's in social media these days, from Dawkins. But he says we should consider ideas, cultural artifacts, cultural units as proceeding in a way that's evolving and is being transmitted analogous to, again, it's a metaphor. All these things are metaphors. They're imperfect. Yeah. It's not a marketplace of ideas. Many ideas have no price attached to them. Okay. There's no, there's no land, labor, and capital. It's different, but it's still a metaphor that tells us something or helps us understand it. Same with the information idea that he has, which is a good one.
It's a great one.
Same with the Darwin analogy. Yeah. It's again, not perfect. There are no,
I'm so sorry.
Go ahead. No.
No, please. I'm so sorry. I think, Greg has been emphasizing this information value of free speech, I think because it's indisputable, right?
Right.
If somebody had, no matter what somebody—
And it resonates with the existing generation, too.
Aren't we better off knowing it than not knowing it, especially if it's speech that is vile? Because then we may want to avoid that person. We may want to argue against that person.
Yeah.
Law enforcement may want to—
Well, it's kind of a weird thing in your book. You're upset at discriminatory people. But then you want to make sure you avoid people who believe in the lizard people theory.
That's Greg. I don't know those people. But I think your point is definitely accurate that for most of our careers as advocates for free speech, we have had to contend against progressive, so-called liberal advocates of censorship because we've been focusing on campus until 2 years ago. FIRE was the foundation for individual rights and expression. And since campuses are so dominated by the left, and that's such an important and influential audience that in fairness, we were addressing them. But I'd be happy to write a sequel about why conservatives depend on free speech every bit as much as every single one of us, regardless of our beliefs or ideologies.
I think we need to kind of bring this to a conclusion shortly. I want to make sure that if Phil has one last topic or so he wanted to bring up, I can get a chance to hear it.
Nick, this is more just a question to pose to you. How do we restore the norms of free speech? And, I go back to look at the survey that FIRE released and other survey data showing both the left and right are in various ways turning against what I think for generations we took for granted is an American constitutional norm. So I see that erosion occurring from intellectual arguments on both sides of the spectrum. But also it has a spillover effect on society at large in the sense that, the toleration for suppression of dislike speech has certainly been on the rise in recent decades and maybe vastly accelerated. What can we do to regain it?
I think by far the most effective and most necessary approach is education, 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 information, information, information. And let me amplify on that a bit. I alluded earlier to the fact that the U.S. Supreme Court, for all of its ideological diversity, for all of its strong disagreements and narrowly split votes on many constitutional issues, has by and large been unanimous or near unanimous in upholding freedom for even the most controversial speech that, unfortunately, opinion polls show that most Americans don't think should be supported. And so I ask myself, how can you explain the difference between the court's speech protective attitude on the one hand, and the public saying we support free speech in general, but and wanting to make exception for hate speech, extremist speech, disinformation, and so forth. And one clear answer is that the justices have legal knowledge. They know what the principles of free speech are. They know the history that gave rise to it, what the actual experience was when we did allow censorship of hate speech and disinformation and so forth. The actual principles of free speech are really commonsensical, as opposed to this caricatured, distorted version that is usually held up by the critics of free speech, who are forever saying, oh, free speech is ridiculously absolute, and you free speech advocates in the Supreme Court never recognize any limits at all to free speech, and you never even recognize that speech can do any harm. All of that is absolutely wrong. Free speech is appropriately subject to some limits. Maybe some of the limits that we have are not appropriate, Bill, but, you know, it's certainly not absolute with no exceptions. And we have to make sure that people understand not only the principles of free speech, but that are educated in how to exercise them in a responsible way, as I said earlier, which means not only learning to articulate their own ideas, but to listen to other people. What are the principles and methodologies and habits of mind for critical inquiry and for promoting viewpoint diversity and vigorous but civil constructive discourse. Fortunately, there are a huge number of educational initiatives, both in the schools and from various civil society organizations, many online resources, and starting as the earliest ages of education. And let me say, another major target audience are education schools, which unfortunately surveys show are populated by people who are extremely hostile to free speech. We have to change that somehow.
Mm-hmm. I would say in some ways, one of my takeaways from listening to you, Nadine, is that there should be almost no governmental or legal limits imposed on free speech. But that leaves a huge space for moral limits on free speech, which are not enforced by violence, by the state or anybody else. People seem to underestimate the significance of moral limits on one's own free speech. That's pretty significant. And you've summarized some complexities for us. I'm very grateful for the time you've taken today. Seems to me that especially with Bill Evers's interesting critiques and so forth, I think this discussion is going to make people want to read the book even more than before. So just as a reminder, here is what the book looks like. It's The War on Words by Greg Lukianoff and Nadine Strossen, 10 Arguments Against Free Speech and Why They Fail. Obviously, if we could talk about this book this much in depth today, think how interesting it would be if you bought it and read it for yourself. So I invite our friends to take a look. And I'm just stopping finally at the end. Do you, Nadine Strossen, have any final summary comments you'd like to make before we say goodbye to our friends?
That every single person in your audience can contribute to exercising that moral judgment and I would say civic responsibility to be informed about what free speech principles are, to inform other people, including government officials who are too often ignorant, and to vigorously exercise all dimensions of free speech, including seeking out and engaging in constructive, peaceful discourse with those with whom they disagree.
Absolutely. Well, let me just offer my thanks, first of all, to Bill Evers and Phil Magnus. Appreciate your comments and participation, especially to Nadine Strossen. Very grateful for you taking the time. Thank you for writing the book. And thank you to all of our friends who've joined us.
I wanted to just close by also saying I really like the book, despite having all these intellectual criticisms.
Every word can always be improved.
Not only excellent treatment of John Stuart Mill, but also of the topic of disinformation, extremely well discussed. And the question of speech codes being in effect in Weimar Germany while the Nazis were rising. So all these people that want speech codes and speech regulations, they had very stringent speech codes in Weimar Germany as the National Socialists were rising, and many National Socialist political figures and editors were put in jail. So the people who think that's going to work to somehow bring civility are, that example tells against them. And that's a great coverage that you never see anywhere.
Thank you for that comment, Bill. And again, thank you to our friends for joining us. I just would recommend to any of our viewers and listeners that you can go at any time to our website, independent.org, and you're going to find this video and others of comparable interest and a treasure trove of pretty in-depth studies of a lot of public issues. So visit us at independent.org, and please join us again on the next episode of Independent Conversations. Thanks, everybody. Take care.